Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. As automation spreads into many realms of everyday life, replacing human decision-making with that of computers, some ponder the possibility of extending the trend to the realm of government. What about a robot for president? Freelance journalist Michael Linhorst wrote about the concept for Politico. He joins us now. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Ann.
You wrote that at one point this seemed like a wild idea, but that now it appears to be much more possible. What changed?
Yeah, so as artificial intelligence has been getting better and better in recent years, the experts I talked to said, you know, it's not as wild an idea as it once was or as it might still seem. It's still at least a couple decades in the future before we'll have a computer that's able to, you know, make all the different kinds of decisions that a president makes. But some experts think that it's certainly possible within 20 or 30 years.
Is this still something that you're thinking about that people would vote for or choose from?
Yeah, so it's how this robot president would actually be elected is up in the air. There are a lot of different ideas. One possibility is we would elect the programmers who initially program the computer, and then we would have periodic elections every year, every 4 years, to decide, you know, what the computer should focus on, what its priorities should be, what side it should come out on things like abortion, you know, really hot topic, hot button issues. But all of that would obviously require significant changes to the Constitution, to the way our government works. So it's all really speculative at this point how we would actually get this president into office.
Would it be a president?
Yeah, that's another good question. We've been, the people I've spoken to, and my article describes this as a robot president, but it wouldn't be a president in the way we normally think of a president. It obviously wouldn't have a human body. It wouldn't be a human. It would be just a computer making decisions. So it's not like it would be going out and kissing babies or shaking hands or giving speeches. But instead, it would just be making the hardest decisions our country requires our leaders to make. And it would be able to bring in all this different information, all the data that's out there. It could consider all the you know, different possible ramifications of its decisions. And the idea is it would come to a conclusion that would be better than any conclusion a human could come to, just because it can crunch so much more data than a human could.
A president does so much more than actually make decisions, though. It would kind of fundamentally change the nature of what we think of as a president, right? I mean, the president negotiates. The president, you know, there's a personal style that comes to a presidency.
Yeah, absolutely. So there are a lot of parts of the presidency that aren't about just making decisions, that are more about, you're right, leading the country, doing things that you would really need a human to do. So we would lose things. Even the people who think it would be a good idea to ultimately have a computer making our country's decisions admit that we would lose things by not having a human in charge. But they say, on balance, having a computer run the country would be better, because the computer could make those decisions informed by data that wouldn't be, you know, full of the biases and human prejudices that we have, you know, grudgingly accepted from our leaders.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about, what if you could make the president a robot? What if you could use artificial intelligence to run the country? What do you think? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Yeah, I'm thinking, what if you just use computers to spit out data and then humans made the decision. What's the difference?
Yeah, so some other people I've spoken to say that's really the best outcome here, that we have computers crunch the data, figure out what the various ramifications are for all the different possible decisions, and then still have a human president making the final decision. And that kind of setup already exists in some contexts. I mentioned in my article there is a private equity fund that a couple years ago announced it was putting a computer on its board of directors. And essentially the idea here was its computer would crunch all the data, would make recommendations for what they should invest in, and then the final decisions would still be made by the humans. So we could adapt that model to our leadership, our country's leadership, and have a computer, you know, crunching all the data, figuring out what decisions would probably be best, but then still have a human make the final call.
Well, did you find out how that company's doing with a computer on its board of directors?
No, I just talked about the initial decision.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, a lot of companies are doing something similar. A lot of institutions are doing similar things where they use computers to advise them, but not to make actual final decisions.
You spent a lot of time in your article talking about the pitfalls of such a scenario. What do you think are the most obvious ones first?
Right. So first of all, technology is not yet at a place where a computer could actually make all these decisions, because it's the nature of the president that only the hardest problems filter up to the presidential level. And those problems are things where there are no easy answers, there's no precedent, everything's a very difficult problem. And those, as you might imagine, are some of the hardest problems for a computer to solve, because there's no precedent, there's no way to train the computer how to solve these unprecedented problems. So the technology isn't there yet. Even the most optimistic people I spoke to think it'll be another 20 or 30 years before the technology is good enough to actually make all these hard decisions. But a lot of computer scientists think that's too optimistic. They think it'll be, many decades or even longer before a computer has all that broad ability to reason through unexpected problems.
It would kind of be the same computer, right?
Yeah, for all the different problems, it would be. The idea is you would have one computer that has intelligence like a human's, where it's very adaptable. It can take on, you know, whatever problems come its way. So it would be one computer doing all this decision making.
And then, as far as, I mean, there are things, I mean, you're talking about there's a technology and the technological capability, but then there's also our ability or willingness or even legal ability to embrace it, right?
Right. So, you know, a big part of the president is the presidency is inspiring people, leading people, convincing people to elect you. So it would take a lot of effort to convince the American public that this is something they should embrace, this faceless, non-human president leading them. Now, on the flip side, we do already have a lot of frustrations with the president, whether it's a president you politically agree with or not. Many, probably most presidents we've had have these personal flaws, real human frailties that threaten to upend their presidencies. And a few instances have really stymied their efforts to do what they got elected to do. So whether it's, you know, Bill Clinton scandals or Nixon with Watergate or you know, Trump's personal flaws, there are a lot of situations where it would be better, theoretically at least, to have a computer without those human flaws running the country. And if you frame it that way, the supporters of this robot president idea think you could actually get the country behind the idea of having a computer in charge, because you wouldn't have to worry about, you know, greed or lust or whatever. The computer would just be making the decisions that, based on the data, would be the best decisions.
Madeline in Westerville, you're on the air. Hi.
Hello. My biggest concern with this would be, it wasn't so much that the computer would actually be in charge, it would be the people who are supplying the data who would actually be in charge. And then we have to think about, well, where is this data coming from? Are our sources real? Are they reliable? Is the computer getting all of the data it needs? And I feel like there's a lot of room for manipulation, both accidental and, you know, purposeful. So, like, it might be something simple like, oh, we didn't know the migration of monarch butterflies was going to be important in this decision, and now we have a terrible thing happening.
Hmm.
Or it could be something as simple as someone was like, well, I'm not going to have a big enough sample size for this particular issue, so look, vaccines are bad for you now. Hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah. What do you think, Michael Linhorst?
Yeah, so that's a really good point, and one of the fundamental problems or risks with this robot president idea. Even if we get a computer that is, you know, smart enough to make the decisions, it'll still be relying on data, and where does that data come from? So we would have to be very careful about where the data comes from, and there are a lot of examples. I cite some in the article about existing artificial intelligence systems that are written to be, you know, non-biased, you know, just make whatever the best decisions are, that still make biased decisions because the data they use is biased. So there's one example of a computer system that recommends to judges whether they should grant bail to a defendant or how much bail they should require the defendant to pay. And the idea with these systems was to take all the, you know, racial bias and other biases out of the decision and just focus on the information available and objectively determining whether the person was a flight risk or a danger to the community. It turned out, though, that the information available carried racial biases that then influenced the computer's decision. So even though the computer was programmed to just be objective, its decisions turned out to be racist decisions. So that's a very good point, that it's important to look at where the data comes from, and if you can't trust the data, you're not going to be able to trust the output.
And what about rules? Would the computer, what kind of rules would it have?
So that would, that's one of the questions about how to create this computer that is very much up in the air. One person I talked to, named Zoltan Isfahan, he's one of the primary proponents of the robot president. He thinks we should first have an election to start off with, to elect the programmers and guide the programmers, make sure we have people creating the system who the majority of the country supports, and then have elections every year, every 4 years to refine the system and tell the system, no, we want you to prioritize this instead, or, you know, focus on the economy or focus on health or whatever the case may be. So voters would still have a chance every once in a while to guide the computer.
Can you really talk about any of this in a vacuum? Can you talk about a robot president of the United States without talking about, you know, a robot prime minister of Great Britain or a robot dictator of whatever totalitarian countries. I mean, how can how would we give up the human role in this if everybody didn't do it?
Yeah, because it would be difficult, as you mentioned earlier, to negotiate treaties or just to interact with other countries.
Mm-hmm.
So that actually raises one of the important limitations that some computer experts see in this idea. They point out that artificial intelligence, at least as it exists right now, can't explain why it made a decision. It can only tell you what decision it came to. And that's in large part because of the way these computers reach their decisions, the way they analyze data. It's all sort of in a black box. You can't see why it came to that decision,
mm-hmm.
and it can't explain it to you. And unless it can explain the decision that it makes, it's hard to convince people if the computer is interacting with humans. It's hard to convince those humans that the decision's right. It's hard to really negotiate anything. So that's one of the other primary limitations that computer experts see here, that if you're going to have a robot in charge, it has to be able to at least convince humans that it's right. And we would probably also want it to be able to negotiate with humans to change its position a little bit based on what the people are telling it.
And value humans.
Yeah, that would be very important too. We would certainly want to make sure the robot doesn't do anything that causes more harm than good.
One of the rules of robotics. Thank you so much, Michael Linhorst, for joining us today to talk about this very interesting and strange topic.
Thank you, Ann.
That's Michael Linhorst, freelance journalist. He's written a piece about What If the President Was a Robot for Politico. You can check out that link at our website at WOSU.org/AllSides. More Tech Tuesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Silicon Valley and the tech industry in general, it's considered a haven for sexism these days. Multiple studies over several years reveal a gender gap, not only in industry leadership, but also in the seed money that helps with startups. Recent allegations of sexism and sexual harassment have led to a spate of high-profile dismissals and resignations, including former Uber CEO Travis Kalanick. San Francisco-based USA Today San Francisco Bureau Chief John Swartz has been covering this story. He joins us now by phone. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me, Ann.
So, John Swartz, how long has this been going on?
This has been going on for decades, actually. This is not really even a dirty little secret. It's been a big secret, but it hasn't been spoken about on the record. I mean, for decades, Silicon Valley has shown, and tech in general, a very low percentage of women as CEOs or in executive positions in the C-suite or as general partners in venture capital firms. What's been going on is you have this, now we call it a bro culture, but it's been in existence for quite a long time, but now it's become more public. And I think the key moment was when Susan Fowler spoke out about the culture at Uber, which led to the changes there, despite a lot of us thought it they wouldn't happen at Uber because that was one of the most notorious cultures in Silicon Valley in terms of sexism. So that kind of opened the door for what we now are seeing, a number of instances of women in particular speaking out against this kind of venture funding sexism. And I think it's going to spill into other areas beyond D.C.
Why was the Susan Fowler episode so impactful?
Well, in a sense, she went on the record. A lot of times, I mean, one of the things I've come across, I've had a lot of female friends who were executives or at startups or within larger companies who would complain to me about what would happen, but none of them would go on the record because, in a sense, bringing up sex charges and it's such a male-dominated industry is almost like dropping a nuclear bomb on your career, as one VC female partner told me. What Susan Fowler did, she went public with documentation, and I think what helped her was in the case of Uber, there were a number of incidents going on, non-sexism issues that had been escalating and calling into question the leadership acumen of Kalanick. And I think that was just another example, and it started to pick up momentum. And then as Uber created even more of a culture of kind of suppression of viewpoints that were counter to its culture or its mouthpieces at the top, you eventually saw more and more kind of an escalation and building of resistance to what they were doing, and maybe even a call into question. I mean, even Kalanick acknowledged that there were certain things that went on there within Uber that needed to be addressed. But the more digging they did into this internally, and the more accusations that came out, it almost became inevitable that he would have to step aside. I mean, he's still on the board, and he still has an incredible amount of influence there. He's just not running the company as a CEO. But the Fowler test case, in a sense, led to these other disclosures. And that's in my opinion.
Okay. San Francisco-based consultancy firm Paradigm advises companies on diversity and inclusion. And joining us now is Paradigm partner Carissa Romero. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
So what is the deal here? I mean, this is supposed to be a younger, back in the day, they're all aging men now, but back in the day, more a younger demographic. It was supposed to be more open, more less segregated, less sexism. What happened?
I think one big problem we've seen is a lack of accountability, and often value structures don't incentivize the right behavior and even encourage the wrong behavior. So if companies want to create equitable workplaces where employees treat each other well, that's going to be a challenge if your company then says that it really values stepping over others and rewards people who do that. So people are going to act in accordance with company values unless there's clear accountability. For both good behavior and bad behavior, we can't really expect to see changes.
And has this been a booming business environment for you, Carissa Romero, then? I mean, are companies reaching out for help?
I think we do see that some companies are taking this as a moment to reflect. I think it remains to be seen whether this is going to be kind of a turning point for the industry. It's really going to depend on whether people really do engage in deep self-reflection and consider how they can be building healthier, more equitable, and more inclusive cultures. And we certainly hope that we can work with companies to help them build healthier cultures that more people can thrive in.
What has it been about the tech world, the culture of Silicon Valley, that makes sexism more prevalent? You said there's the lack of accountability. Is that because it's not unionized? I mean, what's going on?
I think one unique thing about the tech industry is there's often this aversion to process or resistance to structures, and these are often structures that can reduce these issues. So when you have you don't have certain structures in place and there's a lack of accountability, and you also have an industry that's kind of obsessed with finding and celebrating rock stars. And when you have that obsession with finding and celebrating rock stars, it can be hard to kind of figure out how to respond when then those top performers engage in problematic behavior. I also think it's uniquely important that the tech industry get this right. Technology companies are playing a major role in designing our future. The fact that entire populations and communities are being left out and are in cultures that are not healthy and inclusive, that's especially troubling, I think, in the tech industry.
And John, in your reporting, you found that this is echoed, this sexism, the sexual harassment issues and sexism is reflected in the culture of how women struggle to find funding for startups. It begins there, right?
Right, exactly. So very few, there are a couple things in play. There are very few women who are partners in venture capital firms. It used to be 10% in 1999. Now I think as of 2014, it was 6%. So there are fewer people, fewer women doling out the money, or fewer female executives. So, I mean, one of the pitfalls in Silicon Valley is people tend to finance people who they are most like. And that not only applies to gender, but to age. I mean, one thing I haven't mentioned yet is this whole idea of ageism, which is even more rampant. Actually, I think it's a far bigger problem than sexism, and so, which applies to males and females. If you're under 35, you're considered in your prime. Once you're over that age range, you are considered kind of on the downslide. So, so we have that also in play, and also the unconscious bias against non-whites, which is, I mean, so you have all these things happening. And when we don't mean to single out tech, but I think the reason why we're writing about tech is, the reason why tech has been so pointedly criticized is that it presents itself as this kind of progressive culture utopian, mm-hmm. a coastal culture that, in a sense, is no different than, maybe even worse than, traditional industries like banking. When you think about it, I mean, it's not just overt sexism; it's covert. I mean, it's people talking within themselves, talking about playing ping pong games while drinking beer. Mm-hmm. I mean, just kind of innocent, unconsciously biased comments or sexist comments that go on. I talked to a woman yesterday who was fired from an investment fund after only 4 months because she had major problems with the CEO, and his idea of solving an issue is, as he said to her, and I'm quoting him, is, let's just, you punch me, I'll punch you, then we'll grab a beer. That's how we'll get this thing settled. And she says, this is like counter to the way I was raised and where I worked in other large companies. I mean, I can't handle this. So you know, just to summarize, it's something that's just been inherently lingering and throughout these organizations, and they're never addressed because tech, in a sense, thinks they're very resistant to change or to self-reflection or criticism. That's one thing you cannot do, is be critical of a tech company, because they don't like being second-guessed in many cases.
You know, Chris Romero, how much of that, there's a lot of stuff going on here, but it's interesting. John Schwartz brings up the issue of another demographic, which is age. And so I think that might be an issue, because most of the women in the tech industry are young, right? They don't have a lot of older women to look up to help lead the way, to mentor them, that kind of a thing.
I think it's an important point that there are lots of groups that aren't just experiencing overt harassment or discrimination, but there's a lot of subtle cultural biases in these companies. And it's not just unique to the tech industry, mm-hmm. but you know, I think it's important to acknowledge it influences who companies hire, how they distribute work, how they can't promote. It's really important to design systems and processes that promote more fair decision-making and that address these subtle cultural issues as well.
Often the people who are making the decisions are saying, hey, we're looking out for our bottom line, we're looking out for our investors, we're looking out for our shareholders. But John, one source in your story said that companies with at least one female founder performed 63% better than all male founding teams. That's true in business universally. Study after study after study shows it. Mm-hmm. Why doesn't the bottom line matter then?
That's a really good question, because that's something we keep coming across. And even before we were doing our coverage on sexism, we were looking at kind of the predominantly white male tech industry and this reluctance to bring a variety of life experiences and people from different backgrounds within companies. I mean, in the case of a Facebook or even a Google, a large percentage, even in some cases, majority of their users, depending on the product, are not white. And unless you address the diversity or the ideas or embrace other people and their viewpoints, you're going to lose out on potential market share. So I think that figure that you just mentioned kind of underscores the business opportunities that are actually being lost by being so insulated.
Is this a distinctly American issue, or is this true around the world? Do you know, John?
We haven't been covering. Short answer is no. I don't know.
Yeah.
But we haven't been covering tech
sure.
companies overseas. Maybe Carissa knows.
Yeah, Carissa Romero. Yeah.
Yeah, there's been research done in the U.S., in Latin America, in Europe, that shows that companies that have both more gender diversity and more racial and ethnic diversity perform better financially. And that's especially true when companies care about innovation. So if you ask companies, you know, do you care about innovation? That's really where you see this relationship between diversity and better performance. So especially in the tech industry that cares so much about innovation, they really want to be, you know, at the top of their industry doing great work. It's really important to have diversity.
You know, I have a feeling I've been talking about these issues regarding sexism and sexual harassment in business for 40 years now. We're talking about who's in the boardrooms, who's on the commission, who's on commissions that are appointed by governors. We're talking the whole realm of leadership hierarchy in profit and nonprofit, and it's always the same thing. Nothing ever really changes. Carissa Romero, you know, we're talking about a bedrock of sexism now in Silicon Valley. Do you really see it changing very much? Much beyond incrementally and company by company?
I think every company, even those who are committed to this right now, still have quite a bit of work to do. But I do think a number of companies are on the right path, and many are doing things well. So, for example, Pinterest has been really prioritizing creating an organizational culture where everyone feels like they belong. There's a lot of research on if companies don't intentionally focus on belonging, they won't get their best work out of employees. Lyft has really been focused on things like improving their interview process, specifically, you know, how they're assessing for values alignment. So I do think that, you know, while all companies still have a lot of work to do, there are companies that are taking steps in the right direction.
But, you know, you mentioned Pinterest in particular. Wasn't that a female, male co-founders of that company?
The co-founders of Pinterest are men.
They're both men. Okay.
Two men.
Yeah. Jen Swartz, what do you think? I mean, is this just something you're going to be, if you're going to be reporting about this 30 years from now, same old, just like we are with everything else?
God, I hope not. I hope not. But, I think it's going to, as Carissa pointed out, it's going to be incremental. You know, this has been kind of a slowly evolving storyline. What's interesting now, what's different now, is that people are actually talking on the record about their experiences, especially younger females who are at the startup stage. And they're sharing their stories about what they had to endure so that others don't go through the same issues. Now, I mean, I've done panels with female entrepreneurs and VCs 5 years ago where we talked about this very, very same topic, but no one would go on the record. The difference now is that they are. And I suspect that we're actually going to be hearing beginning even more disclosures of more well-known VC names. I mean, up until now, they were smaller investment funds, not as historically well-known mainstream as mainstream as the others. But I actually think we're going to start hearing more instances within larger companies and larger VC firms that's going to start trickling out, because I think the only way you really can make a change to what we have here is by making some fundamental and blowing up some institutions that have been far too rigid in the last 30, 40 years.
Hmm. Well, we shall see, but I don't think I'll be alive to see it. John Swartz, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
John Swartz is USA Today San Francisco Bureau Chief. Also, Carissa Romero, thanks for your help today. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Carissa Romero is a Paradigm Partner. That's a San Francisco-based consultancy firm that advises companies on diversity and inclusion. More Tech Tuesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Yesterday was World Emoji Day, And to celebrate, Apple released images of some of the new emojis it plans to release into the wild this year. Joining us now to talk about that and other tech news is managing editor of Android Central, Daniel Bader. Welcome back, Daniel.
Thanks for having me.
So what did Apple reveal?
Well, it revealed a number of emoji, including a head explosion. If you've been looking for emojis that really let you express just how frustrated with the world you are, you can look forward to using a head explosion emoji later this year, along with zombie and Tyrannosaurus Rex and breastfeeding woman, a woman in headscarf, fantasy people. I mean, it runs the gamut. There's a genie, there's a coconut, there's a sandwich, finally. And you know, the reason I'm talking to you about this on public radio is because emoji is everything to people using smartphones. It may not seem like it to some, but to the average person who communicates using phones every day, emojis are as important, if not more so, than the alphabet itself.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about emojis, and listeners, we've got a few minutes, so give us a call and tell us what your go-to emoji is. Mine's the one with the purple face and the big eyes and the, like, kind of the silent scream, kind of an Edward Munch sort of a thing. I think that's how you pronounce his name, that artist. Okay. So tell us what yours is. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. All right. So what do we know about how they come up with emojis in the first place?
Okay. So the emojis are created by an organization called Unicode. And every year, Unicode reveals a new series of emoji. They're essentially like templates. They're designs that other companies like Apple or Google or Samsung can use to create their own versions. But if Apple or you know, Apple in particular, because it has such influence over the industry, wants to implement these emojis, it has to conform to the standard that Unicode has set. So every year there's a new set of emoji, that many of which are submitted by regular people. The reason that breastfeeding woman, for example, has been included in this year's set is because there was such an outcry for such an emoji for many years, and it's taken this long for it to be standardized and implemented, but it is finally rolling out later this year.
Why is it such a big stinking deal to make to put in an emoji of a breastfeeding woman? I mean, do they have discussions about this stuff?
Absolutely. So Unicode is it's a nonpartisan organization that really takes it makes emoji into something of a, to say religion, maybe putting it a little bit too intensely, but it takes its job very seriously. And the reason is because over the last 10 or 15 years, emoji has become such an important characteristic of digital communication. Apple was really the company that brought it out of its nascent state. Once the iPhone started implementing a separate emoji keyboard into iOS, it took off, and we now have this ubiquity in our popular culture that probably wouldn't have been here without Apple's help. And Apple as well is the first company to implement these new emoji that have been taken from Unicode and implementing them into their new version of iOS. Google's doing the same thing with its new version of Android later this year. And as a result, many people will be able to experience these new characters.
What's your favorite?
I like the thinking face emoji. I probably use it far too often. But
which one does? What does that look like?
It looks like somebody quizzically thinking about what somebody is saying. There's a hand in front of a mouth, sort of on the chin. I think it's extremely expressive, and it really just exemplifies the way that I think about pretty much everything that's happening in culture today.
And that's me with the purple face. And actually, it's my sort of head exploding
emoji, what I would think of. I can't wait to see what Apple has up its sleeve with that. Can I see it today?
You can go to apple.com, and they have a preview. Yesterday was National Emoji Day,
yeah.
So they previewed all their new ones, for
okay.
sure.
All right. And the future of emojis and communication, do you think we're going to see fewer words and more emojis?
A lot of companies like to co-opt emoji into their marketing to try to appeal to millennials, but I don't think words are going anywhere. I think the reason emoji have become so ubiquitous is that they complement words. And I know that sounds a little bit trite, but it really does make a big difference in how people communicate. I don't think emoji will ever replace the written language that we use in our digital communication, but it does bridge. It does bridge gaps to some extent, and it allows you to express yourself in emotion the way that sometimes text can't, and it allows you to imply tone.
Mm-hmm.
And I used this as an example yesterday in a tweet. Samsung has very different ideas of what certain emoji standards should look like. And I put this out on a tweet last night, where one tweet expressing dismay at how a bunch of kids were treated at a camp were, you know, with Samsung's version of a rolling eye emoji. So there's an eye, kind of an eye roll emoji that clearly is meant to express, you know, disdain or at least frustration.
Right.
But Samsung's version actually has a smiley face. And if you're using it and looking at it on a Samsung phone, it completely changes the tone. So it does have an impact on how people perceive text.
The popular mapping and navigation app Google Maps has a new feature. What's new?
Okay, so this one's really quick, but it's got the potential to hopefully improve traffic in big cities. It tells you when the least busy time is to navigate between two places. So you want to go downtown, you have typically a 35, 40-minute commute. If you leave 10 minutes later, 15 minutes later, Google Maps will now tell you you might save 10 or 15 minutes off your trip time. And because it has so much data through its purchase of Waze, which is a crowdfunded mapping service that I'm sure you've talked about before,
mm-hmm.
it can tell you with relative accuracy how much time you'll save if you leave earlier or later. And this is a feature that's rolling out to Android now. It'll be available on iPhones in the next few weeks. And I think it's going to be very useful to many people who drive or take transit.
Used Waze a lot this past weekend, saved a lot of time, I might say, add. Google bought Waze, what, a few years ago now?
A couple years ago for $1 billion. And it seemed like an expensive price to pay. But Google is all about big data, and this company, Waze, has contributed so much crowdsourced data to its Google Maps platform that now, in my opinion, it looks like a bargain.
You know, I wondered, and I don't know what you think, but when we were driving long distance over the weekend in Indiana, the police cars are unmarked, the state police, and it made me wonder as we were driving by two unmarked police cars talking to each other. They must watch Waze as well, right? So when they're saying there's a police officer, a police car ahead, they know that you're hearing the same thing, right? Don't you think?
I suppose so. I wouldn't be surprised. I'm not sure if it's sanctioned by various police departments to use Waze to counter crowdsourced, you know, sightings of police cars.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, enough people submitting these sightings is likely going to have a positive impact, at least in order to prevent people from speeding. I know that people use it to slow down in certain situations in order just to speed up again later on.
Mm-hmm.
But if it does keep traffic slowing down at certain points, it should be safer mm-hmm. as long as people don't misuse it.
All right. Now, Netflix reported a period of growth to investors yesterday. Pretty good one. Things appear to be going very well for the video streaming service. Close to 104 million subscribers worldwide as of June. That's a 2% increase over what they forecast. Was that a surprise to you?
It was a huge surprise to every analyst out there. They
Why?
Thought 3.2 million. So one thing that's been a little bit hurting for Netflix growth is domestic net user increase in the U.S. They were only expecting about 650,000 net additions. They got 1.1 million. They knew that they'd add many international users because Netflix is rapidly expanding in many countries. It's putting $1 billion into its marketing budget this year just to promote it in countries like Brazil and other huge untapped markets. And it's working. But in the U.S., more people picked up Netflix because of the success and popularity of shows like 13 Reasons Why, Orange is the New Black, and the continuing success of House of Cards. And I think it just goes to show that people associate Netflix with very high-quality original programming. That it's shed its old image of just being a place to get old versions or syndicated shows that you've seen already. It's all about the original content. And there's crossover content now, such as Narcos, that is getting huge play in both the U.S. and many international markets.
And a very huge play among younger people, especially.
Yeah, and that's another thing. So Nielsen came out with a bunch of stats yesterday. Amazingly, coincidentally at the same time, showing just how many people in the U.S. do subscribe to subscription video on demand services such as Netflix and Hulu. It's up to 76% of millennials subscribe to something like Netflix. Gen X is 69%. Baby boomers still very low at 51%. And Gen Z or the under 22, for example, it's 73%. Those kids, essentially, they play video games. They don't necessarily watch as much video content.
Still, 51% of the baby boomer population, that's not bad.
It's a lot. It's certainly more than many people expected, considering that, you know, Netflix, it requires a high-speed internet connection, and high-speed broadband is still very inaccessible to some parts of the U.S. Affordable broadband, that is not as easily accessible, and it's still not as easy to set up as cable. So yeah, Netflix is certainly making inroads there. And other shows, other services like Hulu, Amazon Prime Video, those are also contributing to the growth in streaming video services.
They're the competitors. How are they doing?
They're doing well. Hulu is increasing its user base by focusing on not only original programming, but syndicating animation. They just made a deal with the 20th Century Fox to get all of the episodes of Futurama, Bob's Burgers, and they already have Cleveland Show, they have Simpsons, and they have South Park. So they're really banking on animation as a part of its future growth. Amazon, of course, has a huge slate of original programming that's bundled in with its live Prime Video platform. And Amazon, as you know, just we spoke last week, Prime Day, a huge growth market for them. And every time that they increase the number of Prime members, they increase the number of people that see their original programming using
right.
Prime Video.
I mean, Prime Day is about is as much about getting more Prime members as it is about selling stuff.
It is. That's absolutely. So Prime, there are around 90 million people in the U.S. that are expected to have Prime. That's increasing every year. And Prime Video is definitely a selling feature. You know, the deals in Prime Day, we spoke about this. They weren't awesome. There were some great ones. They were mostly around Amazon Echoes and other Amazon branded hardware. But really, it does come down to Amazon's recurring revenue is fantastic.
What a business. Daniel Bader, thanks so much for joining us again. Always appreciate your time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Daniel Bader, managing editor of Android Central. That's it for Tech Tuesday today. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.